you got a question about the insurance industry, the pharmaceutical industry, the doctor industry, healthcare, health policy, any of it, call now, 866-994-6343, because joining us now is one of the best, most articulate experts on all of those issues, a professor of pediatrics. He's a doctor himself at the Indiana University School of Medicine. He's an author. He's got three books now that debunk myths about your body and your health. Don't swallow your gum. Don't crush your eyes. And don't put that in there, which is about sex myths. His blog is at The Incidental Economist. His YouTube channel is very popular because it's produced by the great John Green, who he likes more than he likes me now. And that is the Healthcare Triage. And he contributes, finally, in the most flattering way, to the New York Times. He's a New York Times contributor at The Upshot. Dr. Aaron Carroll is on Twitter at Aaron E. Carroll, 2 R's, 2 L's. Give him a follow. If you're not now, you're missing out. Hey, buddy, how are you?
Good. How are you?
Video games are good for you?
Oh.
Propaganda.
First of all, I think they're phenomenal. So,
yeah, because you're a huge video game nerd.
That's right. But
what are you playing right now?
Jacob and I are working through a game that it was one of those like free downloads for Xbox Gold. It's like Max Brother. I can't remember what it was. It's a very simple sort of game.
Is it Kill the Palestinians? Is that the game?
Oh, God, no. No, you're a little boy searching for his brother, and you have to basically... I don't think you kill anything. No, you're always running away. You don't have any weapons which can kill things.
You play those games.
Oh, God, and, yeah, absolutely.
When I was at your house, I played Medal of Honor with Jacob. I think. And
they might have, actually. Go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, and it's a really fun game, but people argue that it's violent. You know, Val won't even let the girls, like, watch. She doesn't even like some of the violent, like, cartoons and stuff. Wants us to violent video games. And a lot of parents feel that way. But you always like to cite that violent video games don't make people or kids more violent. There's no stats to prove it.
Well, okay, first of all, let's back up a second. Young children should not be playing those games. I'm not arguing about that. So, you know, if Val is saying I don't want my, you know, 6 or 7-year-old little girl to play, you know, games which are, you know, rated M from a... Yes, I totally endorse that. I'm not doing that either.
Right.
But I think that there, you know, is a point at which, you know, whether you're watching it on a movie, whether you're watching it on TV, whether you're playing it or, you know, role-playing it or, you know, video games, there's not a lot of good evidence that says it causes it. And cause is the big word that's important there. There's certainly, you know, you can make an argument that some children without proper supervision, if exposed to tons and tons of violence, be it through any media, could be at higher risk for, you know, having emotional problems. But there's no good study that says that a child that otherwise would have been fine, that has a good family, that, you know, everything else is in place, that's exposed to these things, therefore is going to be bad. And so far too often these, you know, whether or not they play video games in this study is sometimes just a proxy for parenting. You know, playing, you know, 8 hours of video games or watching 12 hours of TV a day is often a proxy for just bad parenting. And so you just can't tell what's going on. I bring this up because the funny thing you said at the beginning about whether video games are good for you is because there was a study just published in Pediatrics that came from a large cohort study in England, which looked at kids who play video games and then, again, emotional outcomes, life satisfaction, and you know, whether or not they had behavioral issues. And what they found was that compared to kids that play no video games, kids that play some video games, like less than an hour a day, but some, do better. And the kids that play 1 to 3 hours do no different than kids that play no video games, and kids that play more than 3 hours do worse. Does that mean that an hour of video games are good for you? No. It's probably a proxy for something else, and I wouldn't go out and say that this proves that, therefore, everyone should be playing an hour of video games. It's just that whatever is probably in households that allow for some but not lots of video games, kids do better or seem to, you know, be associated with kids doing better. And, again, there's no policy prescription in this in video games. I think it just illustrates, again, how you can take these associations and cohorts and you can skew it one way or the other, but it never proves that the one factor that makes the headline is what's really important.
The thing that makes me the thing that I hate most about video games, and I like playing them, and I don't play them much anymore because I can't get into anything anymore. I don't know why, TV, video games, because I've gotten so much more into being outside, really. And so the thing that I really don't like about video games is you know, you don't require, but by most folks play them, most kids play them, most people play them on a television. You got to be inside, and I really think you know about all my environmentalism and activism with that, and the this is not a medical condition, but the nature disconnect disorder that Richard Louv talks about.
I mean, why do you think so much as either or? This is what I don't get.
No, I don't. I don't. I don't. I mean, moderation, but because I you can't tell me, and I've got no evidence, and I know that you demand it. But generally speaking, we are not nearly as our kids today are not nearly as likely to be outside for as long as we were, and we were less likely than our parents simply because you've got more options for entertainment. It used to be go outside and play. You can play inside on a video game. It's a good excuse on a rainy day.
So, I disagree that it's because of the technology. I think there's no proof for that at all. I'd argue a few things. One, parents these days live in a fake culture of fear, where they're afraid to let their kids roam the neighborhood, and they're afraid to. And a woman, you know, just a couple weeks ago was, you know, her child was taken away because she let her child go play in a park a couple blocks away because we're sure they're going to be kidnapped and everything else, when the likelihood of that is like near statistically near zero.
I think that's a huge problem. We've talked about that a number of times. It doesn't
become more urban, in which case there are fewer places for children to go and play out in parks. And in other words, it's like that was a very suburban thing. That was never a huge urban thing, and that has changed. And recognizing that tons of the population lives in urban things, it's often suburban people who are making this complaint about how the days used to be, in which case that they never were that way for a significantly large population, part of the population.
Well, if you just focused on urban neighborhoods, couldn't you just say in urban neighborhoods, people are playing, kids are playing more video games and getting outside less?
There are fewer parks, and there's like, where do they go? I mean, when we don't invest as a population in this as a public health thing, when we don't say, well, it's important.
Because they don't build parks because kids don't play in them because they're inside playing video games.
You think that's the reason? You think that the only thing that's preventing like cities from building parks is that they think children won't use them? Really?
Do a study on the how much a park was used now versus when we were kids.
Again, I think that that's much more about fear than it's so that they have video games.
Fear? I think that's a huge part. I agree with you. I'm not saying I completely disagree. Parents are insane about worry about their kids.
I watched
irrational
more TV
fears.
As a child, I think, than I, in some ways, it's like we used to run home, we'd watch
Three's Company
cartoons in the afternoon. And then and Saturdays, all we did on Saturday mornings was watch cartoons because that's the only time cartoons were on. It was like everyone watched Saturday morning cartoons. My children don't sit and watch cartoons on Saturday morning anymore. This stuff's available more pervasively, so they see it other days of the week in moderation. Right. We play video games probably more in the winter. In the summer, I'd say maybe a total of 5 hours has been spent playing video games in the Xbox One because it's summer. But in the winter, when it's freezing cold in Indiana and you don't want to go out as much, we probably play more. I don't think that it has anything to do with how much, you know, technology there is in the house. Plus, as a society, we have way more leisure time today than we did just 30 or 40 years ago. And they had way more leisure time than they did before 30 or 40 years ago. And some of that time has been filled with technology. Some of it has been filled with leisure activities. So it's not that we've substituted and you only have a certain amount of time. The problem is we have enormous amounts of leisure time. And that is not that's not a problem, but that's what's changed. And some of that has been filled with technology and some of it has been filled with activities. But, you know, you could have another guest on and I bet you would start complaining about how overscheduled your kids are and how they're involved in too many physical activities, many of which are physical, I bet, you know, and they have to go here and they have to go there and they have to do this and they have to do that. And it's the same people who argue about how their kids are doing too much outside of the house who then say they also spend too much time inside playing video games and doing everything else. I think we just can't view the fact that there's more leisure time and that we don't like some of this stuff and we want to therefore start blaming it.
We're talking to Dr. Aaron Carroll. You can follow him on Twitter at Aaron E. Carroll. You can argue or ask him a question right now, 866-994-6343. Let's talk a little bit about the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. I saw a chart yesterday about how well it's working. I also got a call from a guy yesterday, a critic of it, when I was hosting for Michael Smirkanish, talking about how poorly it's working. How do we measure these things and cut through the bullshit?
Well, you know, the number one thing, the number one goal of the Affordable Care Act, you have to remember, was to increase access. It was to
increase access, cover more people with insurance.
That was number one. I mean, that's always been it. And I don't think there are very many people left who can argue that it's not reducing the number of uninsured. I mean, you know, every measurement that I have seen from third-party parties has shown, you know, significant decreases in the number of uninsured. That's probably only going to increase. And that's even after they, you know, killed the Medicaid expansion in a large number of states, which has kept millions of people from getting Medicaid they otherwise could have had. So on that metric, it's succeeding. So therefore, when we want to attack it, now we start moving to secondary metrics where it was supposed to help do some cost control as well. And that's up for debate. No one knows if the slowdown in health care is because of the Affordable Care Act or because of the economy or because of changes in health care. We just don't know. But health care spending has definitely slowed. I mean, no one can argue that either. It's much slower
but,
than it
is. But maybe someone can, and because they have a different point of view, they've been formed differently. So give a call, 866-994-6343. If you think or you've heard that now less people have health insurance due to the passing of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. Is Obamacare knocked you off of your health insurance? Give us a call, 866-994-6343. If you don't agree with Dr. Carroll, the past few segments you've been on, the past few weeks that you've joined us in the conversation, we haven't taken as many arguments from callers, which you see a ton of them during debate. But I'd love to hear somebody because, people are getting their information from a number of different sources. This is what our guest does all day, every day, is research and studies, and he'll answer the question. 866-994-6343 if you disagree with what he just said, based on what? But what about the latest with the court case, the Halbig case, the subsidies issue?
None of those.
Is anything changed on that?
No. I mean, well, now you've got a number of conservatives who are trying to argue that that the circuit court shouldn't hear the case en banc. I think that's very unlikely to win anyone over. I think that they will hear the case. This is going to take, this won't hit the Supreme Court until 2016. Mid 2016. It could be like almost 2 years from now. So, I mean, it's going to be a lot of noise and whatnot, but nothing is going to change in the short term at all for people.
When would it change, though?
I think if they upheld it at the Supreme Court level, that would be, sort of the nightmare scenario where they would have to scramble to try to keep subsidies for millions of people. But I don't know if that's going to happen. I don't know if the Supreme Court will even take the case. I don't know if they will pass a fix before that time. And all of these are I don't knows, but, it's front page news only for wonks at the moment. It will not affect a single human being who has subsidies or has insurance in the next few months or even the next year or two. It's just not going to do anything until the Supreme Court hears the case. Until that moment, this will all stay in place.
Anthony is in Alabama. You just called. Go ahead, Anthony.
How are you doing, Pete? Good morning. Good. Dr. Carroll. Good
morning.
I have a hypothetical for you, Dr. Carroll. I'm always discussing this Affordable Care Act with other family members and such. Love having a conversation. Not arguing. But hypothetically, just say from a political standpoint that this whole Affordable Care Act was repealed, and I'm not for it, but what are we looking at for the foreseeable future? I mean, would it just go back to the way it was, I mean, would it be chaos as far as, getting these health plans back in order the way they originally were and such?
The likelihood of it being repealed is next to nothing because the president is the president. You would have to have a Republican Senate, House, and president. I can't imagine that. But you could see it be stripped away for one reason or another. Am I right about that? Sorry to answer the question.
Well, first of all, today it's not going to get repealed. There's no chance of it getting repealed through 2016. I mean, first of all, the likelihood of it getting repealed, period, you got to remember, requires the House to have a majority, the Senate to have a supermajority, because otherwise I don't doubt that they'd filibuster the bill. So they'd have to pass it with like 60 votes in the Senate, and then a president who would sign it. There's no way the president would sign it. Now the Democrats still control the Senate, and even any projection of what might happen in the next election shows the Republicans picking, even if they get the majority, not a supermajority. So the likelihood of passing that, full repeal is difficult. If they could work it through the way that they don't need to have a supermajority, then these are all possibles. But the chaos that would result would be massive. I mean, anyone who thinks that the problems of enacting the Affordable Care Act were difficult, imagine tomorrow if you just completely upended the entire market by which tens of millions of people have insurance, would all the plans become void, the Medicare donut hole would go away, so seniors would immediately have to pay more, all the Medicare Advantage reforms, all the Medicare reforms, all the payment reforms, all the doctors that had changed their practices with accountable care organizations and hospitals and invested millions, if not billions of dollars in trying to make that work would be gone. It would be huge. It would be almost the order of taking Medicare away.
Yeah.
You had Rush Limbaugh.
That's what I was saying. It'd be a huge just waste that we've already put into it. Plus, like you were saying, I think hypothetically we would just fall deeper going backwards. I just also want to say I read your first two books, Dr. Carroll. I absolutely love them. Can't wait to get you by the bookstore and find the third one, your newest one. And I hope you guys have a good day.
Thanks a lot, Anthony. Describe what these three books are about.
They're all about medical myths. They're all about things that we believe about our bodies. Some of them are humorous. Some of them are more serious, but that everybody thinks are true. And we go through and we show you the studies. We explain why these things aren't true. We don't just say false. We explain because of this study and how it was done and everything else. So the first two books were more general medical myths. The third book is entirely about sex myths. And so much more exciting. Everybody should go buy it. Absolutely.
Yeah. And we talked about that a couple weeks ago, and I'm sure we'll talk about it again. And we're trying to get Dr. Aaron Carroll on the Howard Stern program. Should be on Opie and Jim, too. I mean, it's such a funny, great thing, and you're learning while you're at it. Yesterday, Opie and Jim were talking on their show about Ebola, and they called up their doctor friend, who's a complete idiot, and they woke him up, and the guy's an idiot. Oh, he's a stupid person. Yeah, I'll tell you why he's a dumb person.
Why?
Because the guy... he's like, well, I really don't, know anything about Ebola. If you give me 5 minutes, I can be an expert on anything, but you guys woke me up. But then he started citing movies like I Am Legend as reasons for, to be concerned. Believe that was a zombie biting, movie.
Vampire-ish.
Whatever.
We're coming to New York. So, see if anybody wants it.
Right. In October, everybody should have Dr. Carroll in the studio when he's in New York. We'll do our best, But Ebola, I'm not sure what question to ask you to get you to go the right direction, but, I mean, obviously the paranoia in America that they're bringing these doctors back and that somebody might have had it in New York is just so – it's embarrassing. I mean, Donald Trump's comments, it's embarrassing that anybody would be concerned. And it's really humiliating and frustrating to think that somebody would say, don't bring back a doctor who's given their whole career – and working in these very difficult areas. I know, your colleague Rachel Vreeman goes to Kenya to work on AIDS. I mean, these doctors, they could do a lot of other things, right. And we're going to not treat them in America because...
So first of all, two things I would say to that. First of all, I blame the media as much as I blame people. They are making this story sensational. I can't tell you how many headlines I saw, telling me that either somebody in New York had been diagnosed with Ebola or somebody in New York, just because they were overcalling it and doing a test that almost made no sense. I mean, come on. So they did a test, but then, I saw the media did not cover at all the fact that, no, they were just ordering a test and it's not real and it's not Ebola. So I think the media hypes this because it's good for news. It's good for clicks. And so it's, they get everybody into a rage and then the rest of us get upset when everybody's in a rage. So that's the first thing. And second is that, everybody gets panicked about this. Ebola is the flavor of the month. We got this way about SARS. We certainly got this way about AIDS when it was appearing in the 80s. Everybody was out of control, and they wanted to quarantine anyone that had, HIV. And so I think a lot of this is just we have not done a very good job, period, about talking about how diseases get transmitted and what is, the real risk versus what we the risks that we worry about versus what we're actually in danger from, they're insane. We've talked about this so many times. We're all upset about Ebola when influenza kills thousands of people in the United States every year and tons of us won't even get immunized against it. So, there are real risks out there, period, that you might have a chance of succumbing to Ebola in the United States. That ain't one of them.
Isn't it, what would be more likely that I could get killed by, Ebola or Sharknado?
I'd have to say Ebola, given that there's never actually been a Sharknado. Period.
All right. What about this experimental drug that these two doctors got? I sent you that article this morning, so you would read it, so I didn't have
to. So hard. Look, first of all, so the article, they're basically making an argument. They gave the three people this experimental serum that they've been testing in I think monkeys or primates, but hasn't been even close to human testing for treatment of Ebola. Now, there's two ways to look at this. The first is at the patient level, there's such a high risk of death. They're like, give me anything, I don't care, because they're so panicked. So what do? It's their right, and so they're out of the United States. There's no regulation. They gave them the serum. The problem is, of course, if they get better, we will have no idea if the serum worked or not. This is why we have to do clinical trials, because we won't know what if they die. Well, will the drug have killed them or the Ebola have killed them? We'll have no idea. If they live, will the drug have saved them or will the Ebola have saved them? We have no idea. And when they start telling us that this drug costs, you know, $50,000 a pop, do we start paying for it? We have no idea. And so, we understand the impetus behind letting people have the drug when they're in these situations, but we will have learned nothing, and then we as a society will someday be on the hook for paying for this. And it is not as if there's ever mild Ebola versus serious Ebola. All of the cases of Ebola will be like this. So we'll have to conduct randomized controlled trials in this someday to see if it actually works or not. And it's hard, but that's the only way we can figure out if it does work or if it causes harm.
What about
what dose is worthwhile? We just won't know.
Sometimes you hear, the most painful ones, like the parents of kids who have been stricken with some form of cancer, being upset and complaining that they can't try an experimental drug. What about the laws? I mean, how come these doctors got this experimental drug? That's a big controversy, isn't it?
Not in the United States. It's not in the United States.
Oh, because they got it over there?
Yeah, I mean, if you have a multinational drug company and you have a drug in a country in Africa, we have no say whatsoever in what happens.
But that couldn't have happened here, you're saying? These guys, they could not have been given that experimental drug here?
I don't think that they would have. They could have tried some kind of compassionate use loophole or something like that, but it would have been much more difficult.
Oh, wow.
We don't control what happens in other countries. We can't do that. They can do whatever they like.
You know, we mentioned the paranoia and the media feeding frenzy on the Ebola thing. I don't know. What about on the border? You've seen and heard those types of reports about, you know, the diseases that the folks from Central and South America, like scabies and other things they're bringing over. I mean, those are real. I mean, Border Patrol agents apparently are.
I mean, scabies. I see kids with scabies. I mean, that. Scabies.
But these immigrants, these people are bringing diseases across the border. That's a huge concern. True or false?
People who are unimmunized and bring measles back into this country and then cause outbreaks.
Well, that's not the answer to my question. The answer to my question, and I'm not actually concerned. I'm not concerned. Don't argue with me. I'm just being the Fox News guy.
I'm being snide back. I'm not a – because, okay, so one, there's no – we have no data, as far as I know, on the number of people. We don't know what the issues they're bringing back. But, you know, we're saying disease. If they're bringing back influenza, colds, what disease are people worried about that they're bringing in? Usually it has to be some kind of highly communicable disease that would not otherwise exist in the United States that we're unprotected against. That I do not know of any evidence that any of that is occurring at all. And to say that people are, quote-unquote, diseased, millions of people in the United States every day have – you know, colds or viruses or disease, that happens all of the time. So, you know, I understand, you know, if you know, we don't want people with Ebola boarding planes, but people with Ebola are so sick that that's not happening. They're not coming across the border with Ebola.
Well,
what are
here
they coming
you go.
Across the border with?
Jana Winter, FoxNews.com. Illegal immigrant kids expose federal agents to lice, scabies, tuberculosis, and chickenpox, according to a report.
Okay, back up. First of all, lice, scabies, and chickenpox exist in the United States. You know, those fine.
But they have more lice, scabies, and chickenpox. These
really?
Mexicans.
Have you not been around anywhere? I mean, anyone who's a parent who has a child, when kids get lice, the entire world goes on lockdown. Lice happens every year. Lice happens.
Is Mexican hair more vulnerable to a lice than American hair?
No, it is possible that they just haven't had the chance to get rid of it. But again, lice is not a life-threatening illness. Neither is scabies. And chickenpox, it's like, well, fine, then why don't you be immunized, and then you won't really be as much of a risk. But kids even get chickenpox. Chickenpox still exists in the United States. That is not unheard of. So there's that. Now, with tuberculosis travel, that is a concern. And so, you know, certainly you want to make sure that we take precautions against that. But, you know, we let people travel into countries with tuberculosis all the time.
But that travel's regulated.
How is it regulated?
They have to go through a thing.
I can board a plane anytime I want and go to Mexico and come back, and no one stops me. That's part of
They have a tuberculosis sensor at the airport.
They actually don't. And when they come back, usually if your doctor's good about screening, you know, they will ask questions and say, have you been traveling to any countries that are endemic with tuberculosis? And if it is, then they might do a TB test. Of course, I expect any day now people to tell us that it should be illegal for us to ask about TB. How dare I ask about your travel? That's an infringement on your private rights. And so who knows?
I'd love to hear somebody argue with you on the gun thing, because you wrote a whole piece at the New York Times about that. And I would like to hear somebody try to make a point about that. We've got a few minutes here. Because you know, you set this up. You host the show. You ask the question, because when you're in town, I'm going to let you host the show. I'm just going to take the day off. So you set up the call, and I'll say the number.
All right. So, you know, recently in Florida, they upheld a law which says that it's illegal for doctors to ask patients about guns, because the initial case was a mom who was very upset that her doctor asked if they had any guns at home. I think got into a fight and then was asked to leave, and the doctor said he didn't want to take care of them anymore, or I don't know what happened, but they brought a case and said it should be illegal for doctors to ask about guns in the home. Now, doctors will argue that that's part of safety issues, that, you know, we want to make sure not that we report that the guns exist and that the Fed should come take it. But if you have a gun at home, the follow-up question is, do you keep it locked up and away from your kids and not stored fully loaded with ammunition so the kids could find it and get hurt? Because a fairly large number of kids get hurt every year by guns. And so it's just anticipatory guidance to bring up a conversation about safe storage of guns. But now that's illegal in Florida. Doctors, groups, and many people are upset because it's prohibiting them from doing it for anyone, even people who might want and or benefit from such a conversation. But now that conversation is illegal. Should the government be allowed to tell you what you can what your doctor can talk about with you? Do you support the government getting into the patient's room to tell you what is and is not permissible in speech? Because that's what happened in Florida, and that's now doctors are not allowed to talk about guns. Is that right?
866-994-6343. If you think a doctor should not be allowed to ask you whether or not you have a gun in the house, and that should be illegal, 866-994-6343 is the number. Let's go to Bob in Wisconsin. This is not these calls have been here for a minute, so they're not on the gun issue.
Not
but
a if, problem.
But go ahead, Bob. Oh, Bob, your phone. Hold on, let's try again. Bob, you there? Oh, Bob. Your phone. Wah. Jason, D.C. I'm a nemesis of Dr. Carroll's. They've argued many times before. Maybe. I don't know. It could be another Jason.
Hey, guys. Hi, Jason. You're absolutely right about this fact about helicopter parents and everybody trying to sell us on fear about everything.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's kind of interesting when we look at this video game stuff. It also reminds me of pornography penetration within a society. The higher the level of pornography penetration within a society, the lower levels of rape and sexual crime.
Is that right?
It's kind of like one of these crazy things where it's like, well, what can we do to lower rape? And the answer is make men have easier access to pornography.
See, this is where we go causal, and I won't go causal. In the same way I'd argue about video games, I'd argue that probably there's some metric we're not measuring. Like maybe greater penetration of pornography means higher socioeconomic status because we can afford it and buy it and therefore do it. And maybe in levels of higher socioeconomic status, rape is less common. Now, I'm making that up. I'm not saying that is true. But I bet it is a proxy for something else.
Well, it does go back to the whole Mies Commission where they were trying to, like, they're always trying to make these correlations between,
right,
you know, pornography equals sex crimes. And the answer is actually it doesn't. You know, and again, the problem is so many within society, they have a hard time accepting it. Just like if your kid plays video games, they're not going to become mass murderers. But they somehow, again, like you were talking about, the ability of people to constantly deflect from individuals' decisions into some major cause is screwing up society.
Right. And I've seen some, and there have been some great, sort of mock studies that make this point exactly. I think I've even talked about or posted before. There's a great link that shows the take up of organic food almost perfectly mirrors, you know, the rates of autism in the United States. And
yeah,
no one is making the argument that autism is caused by organic food, but you could make that. And there was another one that, like, there was a study in Seattle where somebody tried to push that, like, how much time TV kids watch was related to ADHD, but they measured TV time not by actually watching TV, but by how much they thought it was raining. And since it rained so much in Seattle, they just assumed the kids were watching more TV. So basically they're correlating, like, rain with ADHD. And these things get silly, or autism, because they're just proxies. They're just correlations. They are not causal. You know, just because one thing is related to the other does not mean it caused it.
But the other thing I'm going to just drop out there is anytime they throw out statistics about anything, there's constantly a manipulation. Like when they talk about car accidents or, you know, auto deaths, they seem to leave out of the total of auto deaths, a quarter of them are people that were hit on the side of the road. They had nothing to do with wearing a seatbelt or anything else like that. And then when you throw out gun deaths, you know, you got to strip out the people that decided to kill themselves with guns.
Well, I would
pornography.
Argue, well, back up with the gun deaths. I'm going to make one tiny, you know, backup for that. For adults, I'm not arguing with you. But if it's a 15 or 16 year old child, I don't think that should be. If they're getting the gun from the home because the gun was not properly locked up, that's, as a pediatrician, that is actually something I would argue about, because if parents would store their guns correctly, many kids would not have access to them. And suicide attempts with guns are way more likely to succeed than suicide attempts without guns. And oftentimes,
that's what I love about Japan. They have the highest suicide rate in the world. They have no access to guns, and what do? They gas themselves there,
or they jump in front of trains. I mean, that's cultural. And again, I'm not saying get rid of guns and the suicide rate will go to zero. No one should make that argument. But I still think it's a pediatric issue. Suicide needs to be on the table in terms of access to guns, because you remember, kids don't even have abstract thought for the most part. They just don't put these things together. They're making an attempt sometimes. It could be keeping them away from a gun actually could make it. And again, I'm saying this, kids. I'm not talking about adults. A 19-year-old can go out and buy a gun and kill themselves, and I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about, you know, if a child has access to a gun because a parent leaves it locked, you know, unlocked and loaded and out, then that makes a suicide attempt more likely to succeed. And so I still think that that's an issue where that shouldn't be removed from the statistics.
Thanks for the talk.
Jason, hanging up. Wow, look at that. Jim in New Jersey.
Good morning. I had a college professor who used to tell us that, you know, sarcastically, that there's a direct correlation between the sale of ice cream cones and the incidence of rape.
What?
Does it happen more in the summer? Is that what it is?
Absolutely. People are out more in the summer. Women are more scantily clad, so we should ban the sale of ice cream cones because women won't be raped as much.
Yeah, I mean, you can play at this all day. In fact, I think there's this website called like Spurious Correlation or something like that, where they keep finding things which absolutely mirror each other. This is the problem with doing, you know, cohort studies. And we're making light of some of these other ones, but, you know, whenever we have a conversation, and we've talked about this before, where they say, like, oh, it turns out that, you know, acetaminophen causes ADHD if pregnant women take it. These are all cohort studies and associations, and all you can take from that is, okay, it's possible that one could cause the other. Now we need to do a study to see if that actually happens. And either that study never happens, or they do the study often, and it turns out one had nothing to do with the other. But nonetheless, there's a huge body of evidence out there which is all about correlations, and correlation is not causation. That is, they're not the same thing, and very often we just make that leap.
I just hope you're not going on having an ice cream cone. I don't want you to hurt women.
No, I appreciate that.
Depends. I can't even laugh at that. All right. Before we let you go, and you're going to be joining me later on, so I'm going to give you a break. Herd immunity. That's your new video at Healthcare Triage. Vaccines and herd immunity. And I'll tweet that. I'll retweet that right now at Pete Dominic. But you should be following Aaron Carroll as well, so you can see that video. But what is this? I haven't seen it yet.
It's the idea that, you know, we keep talking about vaccines for kids in terms of protecting your kids. And it's like parents are like, well, it's an individual decision, and it's my decision, and I can do whatever I like. And I can do whatever I like for my child. But we lose sight of the fact that you don't just get vaccinated to protect yourself. You get vaccinated to protect people that can't protect themselves and protect others. There's lots of people in the population who can't be vaccinated. Young babies cannot be vaccinated against everything, and they need protection. And there are lots of kids who are immunocompromised and can't receive vaccines for certain reasons, and they need to be protected. And the elderly often have less well-functioning immune systems, and they need to be protected. And we vaccinate because if enough people get vaccinated, then everyone's protected. There's really no disease out there in the population. There are no outbreaks, and everybody is much safer. But if too few people get vaccinated, we lose that herd immunity, which is what that is. And then outbreaks are more common and people are susceptible. And the best example that I can give of this in a positive way is the chickenpox vaccine was introduced back in the 90s. And a study was published in Pediatrics a couple years ago that looked from like 2001 to 2007 or something along those lines about how many kids were being hospitalized or died from chickenpox. And they could show that over time, the number of children hospitalized and the number of children who were dying nationally really decreased. It was quite impressive. But what was most impressive was that the number of babies, kids less than 1 year of age, dropped so dramatically that by 2003 to 2007, which was, you know, the end of the study, not one baby died of chickenpox in the United States. And you have to remember, no babies are immunized. We start giving that vaccine out at 1 year of age, so they weren't protected at all. But the herd immunity, the fact that we immunized everybody above the age of one, or we tried to, was so good that no babies died. You don't just immunize to protect your child. You're immunizing to protect babies nationally. That's how it works. And the recent outbreaks of measles, the recent outbreaks of other communicable diseases, all start almost always in unimmunized children. They come in, they get passed to unimmunized children, and when enough children have it, real outbreaks occur because vaccines aren't 100% protected. They're not. They never have been.
Right.
And without that herd immunity, everybody's at risk, which is why, you know, New York just won an appeal to have the right to tell unimmunized kids that they are not permitted to come to school during outbreaks, often for weeks at a time.
Really?
That's how.
If there's an outbreak of measles and your kid,
they can keep you
is not immunized.
Yeah.
I can. So the school, though, but just to be clear in that situation, the school is taking care of your kid because you won't. It's not right. That right.
That, they're protecting. Not only are they protecting your child, they're protecting the other children in the school. Because, again, the vaccines aren't 100% protected.
Right.
And some kids, what about the kid that also can't, what about the kid with cancer who just is not, you know, can't have the vaccine or a vaccine because they're immunocompromised? They're at incredible risk. Should they have to stay home? Because, so the school system basically in New York has started with, when outbreaks occur, they are saying certain children, you're not allowed to come to school until these outbreaks are contained. And one of them was a sibling who was also unimmunized and then wound up getting the measles. So it's hard to make an argument that that was a bad call. But a number of these parents sued the school system, and it went to appeal, and they lost in the circuit court. Now, I don't know if they'll keep appealing it, but that's how I sort of got into the idea that we need to write this.
Can you believe that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is a anti-vaxxer?
Yes. I've gotten to the point where I can believe almost anything. Yeah, I mean, it's. I don't understand.
Can you
why.
Believe that? Isn't it a more liberal? Aren't liberals more susceptible to that conspiracy than conservative?
I don't know. I find that this one's on both sides of the aisle. It's like, you know, some of these sort of far out ones. You have people who mistrust government so much that they think anything that's mandated is a conspiracy, and you have people who, you know, think the pharmaceutical industry is only about doing damage and that they're making gazillions of dollars off of vaccines, which they're not. And that's why it happens. But I don't know that it is a right or left. It is just wrong. I mean, I don't know how else to say it.
Dr. Aaron Carroll, find him on Twitter at Aaron E. Carroll. Watch his videos on YouTube, Healthcare Triage. They're great. Share them with your friends and read them at the New York Times. He'll be joining me later on in the when are you coming on with me? I'm hosting Michael Smirkanish show right after this. 3 more hours of radio. I'm glad to have you there because my voice is kicking out on me.
Awesome. I think 10 o'clock
on Smirkanish, Sirius XM, POTUS Channel 124. Thank you, Aaron.
Thank